7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. Always good to see you guys. We've been in Points Yonder. I was down in steamy Phoenix. It was only 110, so the temperature's coming down. It's becoming balmy down there now. I think they're waiting for the monsoon to hit so that it'll cool things off. But, you know, definitely makes flying interesting, for sure.
Well, I was in Florida. I had a TV program to do in Florida, and the temperature was in mid-90s with humidity to match, so it was not fun. It was not fun. And guess what? The airlines got another suitcase of mine, and they got it good enough that I had to go buy one down there in order to bring all my clothes back.
I think you need to switch airlines, John.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we got Todd, who's sitting in, you know, paradise.
Well, hey, got up to like 85 degrees here in Palo Alto. It's like,
yeah. Bullets. Oh, yeah, I can tell. I can see it every time we see you. So anyway, I think we got an interesting accident to dissect. Todd, you were scouring the internet for something interesting and outside the United States, and I think you found one. You know, we have been talking about mental illness, mental health with pilots and even mechanics. But, you know, again, you don't really hear about it now. There was a recent pilot trap-lined, Southwest pilot, who was trap-lined by supposedly TSA. There's body camera video floating around the internet challenging whether or not he had been drinking and smelled of alcohol and things like that. And while that's still an ongoing investigation by, of course, all of the alphabet groups, especially because it's a commercial airline pilot, you know, these kinds of things are happening in general aviation, not only here in the United States, but around the world. And while alcohol, you know, tends to be the drug of choice, if you will, we do have legitimate operations where you can take THC in certain states through a variety of different means, including gummies and brownies and drinks and everything else, which, again, as a warning, at least here in the United States with pilots, because that pilot certificate, that mechanic certificate, or any other certificate that you've been issued by the FAA is a federally issued certificate, it is a federal offense to be operating or working on or being around with a certificate, any aircraft that you've either been drinking or had some exposure to illicit drugs and even in some cases prescription drugs that are on the no-fly list, because it is a federal offense. The state that you live in, even though they may allow gummies and THC sales and all that kind of stuff, and even to some extent some CBD that has some THC in it, that is still prohibited. And therefore, the state does not take precedent over federal mandate with the FAA. So you can't drink, You can't take drugs and operate an aircraft in any way, shape, or form. So with that being said, Todd, why don't you introduce us to an accident that has taken place down under?
Well, before we go there, I'd like to add another reminder for what you just said. Not only can you not consume any kind of THC or marijuana product, you cannot carry it on the airplane, period. It does not matter what state you're in or your state of mind. Marijuana, THC, and all those other illicit drugs should not be in your airplane. Anyone's going to come on your airplane and they want to have some with them, casually invite them to sit in the ready room for the next few hours.
And on top of that, if we're going to keep talking about that, secondhand smoke. So if you go to a party and it is a smokehouse, secondhand smoke can trapline you as a pilot because, again, you just, even though you may not have actually done it, but if you've been exposed to it, inhaled it, it will reside in deep muscle tissue in your body for some period of time. So, you know, you still have to, you know, weigh the risks when going to an environment where there is a possibility of exposure. So, I mean, look at John. I mean, he's spaced out all the time. So, you know.
You know, I can't help but remember that there was a former U.S. president who famously once said, "I tried it, but I did not inhale."
I experimented with marijuana a time or two, and I didn't like it, and didn't inhale, and never tried it again.
No more talk about THC or Jack Daniels or my good buddy Johnny Walker. We're going to go down to the land down under, where, unfortunately, this is one that involved alcohol in a tragic sort of way. This was a August 12, 2024 event down in Cairns, Australia, and please forgive me if I mispronounce that, city in Queensland, gateway to the Great Barrier Reef. And there was a helicopter company where this gentleman worked. He was a commercial pilot, certified in New Zealand. He was working for this Australian company. Although he was certified as a commercial pilot, he was doing ground-related work, fuel trucks, etc., with this company. He and some of his friends went out one night. There was some drinking involved. He went back home, tiptoed into the airport. The hangar doors were open. The keys were left in the helicopter, something that the for security reasons, they recommended that you don't do that in Australia or anywhere else for that matter. That said, he took the aircraft out, started flying it around downtown, under 500 feet, did a couple of passes past his apartment building, and joyriding until things took a tragic turn. Toward the end of his flight, and we have a clip playing in the background that is a recreation from the ATSB, the Australian Transportation Safety Bureau, that shows the final path of this aircraft, went right past a what looks like a 15-story building, went on a sharp increase in altitude, rolled over somehow, and crashed inverted on top of a hotel. The person, unfortunately, was killed, and you can see some of the damage both to the hotel and the rooftop and pieces of helicopter here, there, and everywhere. On the surface, it's like, well, this is cut and dry. The person was drinking, and they crashed this aircraft. But a couple things didn't make sense to me. One of them being, it's one thing to fly around joyriding around town, and he was apparently low-level flying but stable all this time. Yet at the very end of the flight, he did something that put the aircraft in an unrecoverable situation. Why? And even more intriguing, in the executive summary, they said something in effect of he had been drinking before and during the flight. Yet there was nothing in the report that said anything about how they know who's drinking during the flight. So it says to me there's information in this report that didn't end up in the final report. It's somewhere back in the files. Now, in the U.S., the NTSB typically has a public docket, which we've mined repeatedly for information that gave us a lot of insights into what was going on. There is no public docket here. There is a video that they put out that summarizes what's in the final report, but that didn't have anything about the background information. And more to the point, I said to myself, this looks like the kind of profile you see repeatedly, not just in the States, but around the world. Someone is flying an aircraft. It's a single pilot operation, no other traffic in the area, and the aircraft crashes. And you say to yourself, why? Sometimes you find out later, person had some personal issues, broke up with their boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever the case may be. I suspect there might be something like that here. You're around aviation. You know, Greg, you're an instructor, and I fly with people. And what's your role? You're not a psychologist. You're not a psychiatrist. You're not a social worker. What's your role if you think that somebody is not in their right mind?
Well, there's a number of things there, Todd. And yeah, you know, I don't have all the fancy letters behind my name, but because my office partner is a forensic psychologist, we have these conversations all the time. And because mental health, mental illness amongst the aviation ranks is now really coming to light, especially after Air India and a few other accidents, German Wings and things like that. One of the issues that I bring up with some of the kids that are young people that I mentor is the fact that if they're flight instructors, it's about looking at your student. I don't care if your student is 17 or 97. Is there a change in personality? Have you studied their personality? Are they outgoing? Were they, you know, engaged and things like that? But on a particular day, they showed up. They're very introverted. It's apparent that there is something wrong. You need to query them to really find out from them, are you okay? Because, John, the FAA mandates us to do a self-examination. You know, the I'm safe, you know, mnemonic where you're checking, you know, do I feel good? Am I sick? Am I on medication? Am I doing all of these things? Am I prepared physically and mentally to actually operate an aircraft? And while a self-assessment, we talk ourselves out of being sick, or we come up with excuses why we can make things happen, even when we know we shouldn't try to make things happen. It's about having someone else observe. And it may not be on the day of the flight, but, you know, you worked in a maintenance hangar, John. I'm sure there were times when guys would roll in, you knew them very well. They had a certain personality, but on any particular day, you know, they just were off. They weren't themselves, you know. I mean, did they kick the cat on the way out the door? Did their wife just kick their butt out of the house? What was it that changed their personality, their character, and did that have some sort of adverse effect on their performance, whatever that may have been?
You know, I give speeches all the time to hangar people. I call them chat on the back porch. And I tell them in part of that presentation that they are their brother's keeper. I've had to put at least one person in the corner. I wouldn't even put him in his car, back in his car, because he was had been drinking too much. And I've had some other people that were going through messy problems that I had to watch. And one time I didn't. I'll get to that in a minute. The messy divorces are probably the number one cause that I have seen for that change in personality. And one guy in particular I had, and he was going through a messy divorce. The wife was using the kids as a weapon, and he lived for his kids. He did every sport with them. He just, every moment that he had off, he was with his kids. And he came to work one night, a basket case. We had a horrible night working on. Going on, and we had a landing gear issue, and he was the best guy on the crew for landing gears, and we put him on the landing gear. I did it. Put him on the landing gear and didn't watch him. And that airplane took off in the morning, and the gear couldn't come up. Thank God. Because if he had screwed the adjustment up in the opposite direction, it wouldn't have come down. So the airplane come back, big deal with the FAA enforcement, the whole nine yards. In the hangar environment, the leads, the crew chiefs, whatever you want to call them, supervisor, they are the ones that have to watch these people. That's their herd. They need to make sure they manage their herd. But in the cockpit, it's one or two people. It's a lot more difficult.
Yeah, it really is. And in getting back to the accident we're talking about, Todd, you brought up that, you know, there were some curious things that weren't talked about in the report. While there is a summary of this pilot's medical information related to his pilot certificate, they just say that he had a significant amount of alcohol. Well, here we typically will put what that level of alcohol was because we gauge it against whether he had exceeded the legal limit and then by how much. They just said a significant amount. And then two, the point you brought up about the fact that there's nothing mentioned in the report that he was drinking in flight, but through this video that they produced, they did talk about he had been drinking in flight. What led them to that? Did they find open bottles or beer cans or something in the wreckage? Why didn't they mention that? How did they know that he was drinking in flight? And things like that. And then, of course, they didn't do any real background on him with regard to his mental fitness, like you were talking about, Todd. Looking back to see, did he just break up with somebody? Did he have a life event that had an adverse effect on him? A death in the family, you know, and things like that. They should have looked back at least those kinds of things. Was this just, I can't believe that this guy's going to go out, steal the helicopter, because that's what he did. He stole the helicopter. It was an unauthorized flight, according to the ATSB. That he stole the helicopter. He went out joyriding. And like you said, he was below 1,000 feet. And most of the time, he was below 500 feet, yanking and banking around high buildings and stuff until the very end, which is very suspicious. Because if he was able to navigate for the first 5, 10, 15 minutes around these tall buildings, and he was coming back almost on the same flight path, and then all of a sudden, you know, he whacks the building, it leads one to believe either the inebriation got to him and he got a little disoriented because it was at night, he had the lights in the helicopter off. We don't know how much lighting was in that particular city area. Or did he decide that this was going to be his final act? He pitched up, rolled that thing inverted, and decided it was time to go in, and he hit whatever was in front of him. And while people go, so what? Who cares? What does that matter? Well, it does matter because, again, we're trying to identify trends. Were there precursors? Did people know this person well enough to go, yeah, you know, John used to come to the hangar all the time, or John came in and pumped gas all the time. He was happy. He, you know, wasn't disgruntled or anything. But then 2 days or 3 days before the event, they start to see a change in personality, a change in character. He's getting sloppy. He doesn't really care. Those are precursors that somebody should be at least, you know, identifying to a supervisor so that they can say, hey, what's going on with you? And maybe seek assistance. But like you said, John, we are our brother's keepers. And when you're in a cockpit, yeah, one pilot may be challenging another pilot going, are you good to go? On the floor, yeah, you know these people, whether you're a line guy working with another line guy or a supervisor. It's like, man, you know, John's really off his game today. And Todd, I know that you're always off your game, so everybody's suspicious of you. So,
especially when I talk about subjects like we like to talk about here on occasion. But let's not talk about those things right now. But let's talk about specifically some stressors. Now, clearly, there was one stress going on. He was drunk. The other stress is he's flying an aircraft. Even if you're not drunk, flying an aircraft is a somewhat stressful situation that you can control because you train for it. But this is lining up several stressors or several risks at once. And we're reduced to reading between the lines as to what was going on in this pilot's life. For instance, he got his license in New Zealand, and the report mentions there is an agreement between Australia and New Zealand for equivalency for his license. So a month or so after he gets to Australia, he gets his license for Australia. A month after that, he joins the company. This was April of 2023. And the accident in question happened in August of 2024. So he's working with the company roughly 16 months before this happened. He was not working as a pilot. He was working as a ground crew member. And they listed the kind of things he was doing.
Basically ground services, fueling, moving aircraft, things like that.
And he was doing this for quite some time. And here's the key thing. The day of the accident happened in the early morning hours. The day of the accident, he was due to transfer to another location within the company to do similar duties. And the night before, he's out drinking with his friends. So I can't help but think, why was he drinking so much? Was he loving what he'd been doing there? Was he hating what he was about to go do? Did his friends overhear something where it's like, oh, this is just crazy talk. This is just Jack Daniels talking, not our buddy here. But clearly there are things going on in this person's life. One of the things is a speculation, career frustration. He hadn't flown a helicopter in about 6 months. He'd gotten his license, back in 2023 in New Zealand. And he's working with this company every day, looking at people doing things he wish he were doing. I'm speculating again. And now they're, instead of putting him into a slot where he's flying in the helicopter, he's going to be driving a fuel truck again, only in a smaller city, some little island somewhere. This is an obvious thing for me that should have been discussed. Maybe it was, and they just didn't put it into the report. But to make this useful to the community, not just in Australia, but around the world, what are some takeaways from this that we're going to talk about, but that the ATSB did not talk about? Useful takeaways that we can use to make things safer for ourselves and the people around us.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
What's the best part of this job?
I would say just the amount of knowledge that I've been able to gather kind of about the GA industry in general. In the time that I've worked here, I feel like I've learned so much just from speaking with people on the phone, doing my everyday tasks in my job. We were able to do a ground school with a local CFI, which was super insightful. We lectured about 9 hours. I felt like I've learned so much.
Have you had an opportunity to fly the simulator you have here in the office?
Yes, I flew, I want to say we did at least 2 hours, I think, and didn't crash, did some successful takeoffs and landings.
That's a good
local pattern. So it was very cool to kind of get some insight into what our customers are doing, on a day-to-day basis, the training they're doing.
So with that knowledge, did that give you a better understanding when you're talking to a prospective client?
Absolutely.
What their needs are?
Yes. I feel a lot more confident speaking to people because I kind of understand where they're coming from, the types of aircraft they're discussing, the types of training that we're discussing in terms of, getting training discounts on there, asking, have you got your private certificate? Have you completed the ground school portion? What have you done? So that's been, I would say, very helpful.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
Yeah, one of the things that you were starting to mention about his pilot qualifications, he didn't have a hell of a lot of time. He only had 157 hours of total time. He held a commercial certificate, so either he was a good pilot, and I know that the rules and regulations for certificate issuance down there is a little different than it is here. The one thing that the report did talk about is that he did have a lot of time in the Robinson R-22, and he was checked out. See, other countries, including Canada and other places, you formally have to be checked out and maintain that proficiency, unlike here in the United States, where you basically are self-policing, where you go out and do 3 takeoffs and landings at night to get current, carry passengers, yada, yada, yada. But He did not have the proper checkout for a similar type aircraft called a Gimbal G2. He was checked out in the Gimbal G2 at night, but not in the Robinson R-22 at night. And now he's flying a helicopter at night that he's not familiar with at night. Could that have played a role, especially given the fact that he didn't have a lot of time and, like you said, he hadn't flown in quite a while? These are the kinds of things that you got to start to ferret out. Again, is this an operational issue? Regardless of the fact he may have been, influenced by alcohol, it's apparent that he was able to get the helicopter out of the hangar, started, fly around for quite a while over a variety of different landmarks, and maintain control at a pretty steady state, because as I recall in the report, they said, yeah, he was at about 500 feet most of the time, which, you would think if you're drunk, you're up and down and left and right and all. He kind of flew it like he knew what he was doing until the very end. So these are the kinds of questions that, what does it matter? It matters because, again, if there were life events that were influencing not only his reason for drinking, but his reason for then operating this aircraft, it may tend or at least lend some idea as to whether or not this was an intentional act to take his own life, or this was an inadvertent or unplanned accident, and the only thing that really contributed to it was his inebriation.
How would you compare this accident investigation to one that would have been done, let's say, 30 years ago in the U.S. with the NTSB, where it's clearly a case where someone was either deliberately trying to kill themselves or under the influence of drugs or alcohol? This would have been a time without the public docket. This would have been a time when the average report, especially for a non-major one, would have been fairly short. Would this have been a one-paragraph explanation, or would it have been better or worse than what we see here from Australia?
And the Australians put together, what, a 7-8-page report. They put a lot of information in there, especially about the flight path, the wreckage reconstruction, and things like that. But they were very, very scant on the piloting issues and, of course, the alcohol, other than to say he had significant alcohol. I can't say how the NTSB would have done it. I know how I did it and how I would continue to do it. And that is, I would have, and the NTSB now has medical people on staff. I would have turned it over to them and say, okay, yep, here's his blood alcohol. This is what came back on the tox. Can we find out? Can we do a 72-hour look back like we typically do in a major? Can we do a 72-hour look back? Can we go interview coworkers? Can we interview family to find out if there was a reason for him drinking? Was this a systemic problem? Was he a systemic drinker? I mean, he may have been a functioning alcoholic for all we know. And on this particular day, he just got a wild hair up his butt and decided to go joyriding. Who knows? But if we have the subject matter experts, why not use them and let them try and ferret this out? Is this a systemic problem or was this a one-off?
You know, and I think Australia has more restrictive rules on what can be said about a person. You know, I think their medical, what we call HIPAA here in the U.S., I think that's even stronger in the Commonwealth countries like the U.K. and Australia and Canada as well. So that may be the reason why it's not in the report, but they have it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, you know, again, there is always a lesson to be learned from every single accident. And while it's easy to write this off to the obvious, yeah, he was drunk, he crashed, killed himself. Okay, great. What benefit is it to, you know, the aviation community, Todd, like you were talking about? There is a benefit. Again, we're getting into this mental health issue, and we got to be, you know, paying very close attention. Why? Because that guy could still be operating in my airspace if he hadn't killed himself. You know, and now he presents a danger to me and what I'm doing and the people I'm flying. And oh, by the way, I think he's very fortunate because he crashed into a hotel that those rooms, I don't know if they were occupied or not, but he didn't kill anybody on the ground. And one of the things that I try to emphasize when I give safety presentations as well, and that is, as a pilot, I'm responsible for, of course, myself. I'm responsible for the people that are in that aircraft with me. I'm responsible for the people that may be operating another aircraft in my close proximity. But there's one more aspect. You're responsible for the people underneath that aircraft because they sure as hell don't want you ending up in their living room. And so, you know, again, they're very fortunate in this particular accident that that hotel room didn't have people that could have sustained serious or fatal injuries because the majority of the wreckage went blasting through a window with spinning rotor blades and everything else. And there was, of course, a post-accident fire. You know, that could have been a lot worse than it was. And so there is always a lesson to be learned. And I think that this, along with a number of other accidents we've talked about on past shows, and we're going to talk about in a future show when I get my office partner, who is a forensic psychologist, on, and a pilot, to talk about these issues and what the FAA here in the United States is at least doing to try to address this, as well as the airlines, because the subject continues to come up. And I know, John, you know, everything that happens in the cockpit happens in the hangar when it comes to being a human. I mean, distraction, complacency, depression. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you fly it, fix it, or manage it. You're a human, and, you know, you can suffer the effects of all of these things.
And do, never mind, can do. Yep. And that, and since the maintenance is usually a larger pool of people, And there's celebrations all the time, people coming and going and events in people's lives. It's the temptation is there and the opportunity is there.
Yeah. Well, with that, Todd, I will leave you with our second to last word.
Well, my second to last word is sort of like picking up where this report left off. They left off at the point of, what can you do about this? Well, other than not drinking, you can do that, but certainly you cannot avoid life events like you and John are talking about. So not only do you have to do your own self-assessment, do it for those around you. Now, you may not be in a position to order someone not to do something, but you are in a position to stop for a minute or two, ask a question, ask them how they're doing, you know, give them a chance to talk things out. And if things seem to be taking a turn for the worse, do what you have to do to keep that person and the people around you safe.
I think that's a great second to last word. So you're going to have to try and beat that one, John, with our last word.
Yeah, I'm going back to my standard because it just seemed with them over and over and over the same problems. And that is lack of planning. So if you're going to go flying, you've got to do a good job of pre-planning your flight. Do it at home. Do it again at the airport. Make sure they agree. If they don't, find out why. When you get out to your airplane, do a good pre-flight. I mean, it's just unbelievable, the pre-flights. I just saw one this week. And, you know, I'm reluctant to go approach some of these pilots and let them know that they're being watched. But so far, I haven't had the ability to do that. But one of these days, I am going to go ask somebody about that. But you need to do a good pre-flight. I had another conversation with somebody that told me that they went and found the mechanic that they found that was working on their airplane and asked them to show them what to look at for his flight controls. I would have asked more, but at least he asked for the flight controls because we talked about the Mooney just recently. And so the pre-flight's so damn important. And after you get in the air, given the airplanes around there today and the number of near misses that we have or close calls, you got to put that head on a swivel. Geez, it's just unbelievable the number of people that are out there making mistakes. So you've got to really pay attention. And that includes on the ground. You know, I've been amassing data, bullets, events, on-the-ground accidents. And guess what? You can't see it, but all these pages of paper, that's all stuff that's happened at just a limited number of airports, because I don't have the ability to get it all, but a limited number of airports that people taxiing into the fuel farm, taxiing into other airplanes, running over the runway lights on the way out to get in position to take off. I mean, and just on starting the engine with a tow bar attached. All right, goodbye propeller. It's just unbelievable. So please pay attention out there and fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you, so we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Whether you're a student pilot, CFI, borrowing or building an airplane, or looking to buy, Avemco Insurance Company can help you find the right insurance coverage based on what you fly and how you fly it. No gotchas. No runaround. No confusing language. No middlemen. Avemco Insurance Company values safety and is a proud sponsor of the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety today. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're a Flight Safety Detectives listener.